I would like to acknowledge the Dharawal people, the Aboriginal people of Australia whose country I live and work on. I would like to pay my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging, and thank them for sharing their cultural knowledge and awareness with us.
Hi there, everyone. I'm Tricia Carter, an organisational psychologist and explorer of cultural intelligence. I'm on a quest to discover what enables us to see things from different perspectives, especially different cultural perspectives, and why sometimes it's easier than others to experience those moments of awareness, the shifts in thinking. As those of you who have listened to some of the earlier episodes will be aware, cultural intelligence, CQ, capability to be effective in situations of diversity, is made up of four areas: motivational, knowledge, metacognitive, and behavioural. And it can help us as we move across cultures. And today I'm speaking with someone who works with students. I'm here with Tim Barrett. He's an Australian educator who works with high school students and has been working on cultural intelligence at their level. I met Tim through CQ Fellows, and we have been recognising each other's work since. So, Tim, why don't you introduce yourself?
Thanks, Tricia. Hi, everyone. Great to be here. And I have to say I have listened to quite a few of the previous episodes, so I'm stepping into very big shoes, but glad to be here. Yes, I am in education in Australia. I have been for the last 25 years or so, and CQ is one of the areas that we've really honed in on as a school, the school I work in, and we'll be talking a little bit about that through the podcast. But my background is a bit of a varied one. I was straight out of school. I went to school in Sydney, joined the army. I was in the army for 4 years, and it's actually in the army when I realised I wanted to be a teacher, funnily enough, because I don't know if you know this, but in the military, you actually have to do a lot of learning. You have to learn about weapons, tactics, just how things operate. And the way they taught was so bad, I vowed to myself, I could do a much better job. So that was my impetus for getting into education.
Your drive.
Yes. Yep. And then I became a PE teacher. And then I did that for a few years. And then I went and studied theology, so another degree, and I became a college chaplain. So I mixed my PE teaching with chaplaincy work. And now I am the head of St Andrew's Institute of Learning, which is a research and innovation unit within St Andrew's Anglican College in Noosa, in Queensland, a beautiful part of the world.
Beautiful part of the world, absolutely laid back, but also wonderful,
yep.
Warm,
yes.
Really nice. Yeah, so interesting, because our next question is around culture. And so a lot of people would say, you know, the Gold Coast culture, Noosa is above the Gold Coast.
Sunshine Coast,
yeah. Sunshine Coast culture is one they love, but Tim, what is a culture other than the culture you grew up in that you have learnt to love and appreciate?
I love to travel, and I have a real love for numerous cultures, one being Japanese cultures. We have a partner school in Japan. I have a lot of good Japanese teachers as friends, and we often have exchange students from Japan who come to the school, and I love many aspects of their culture. But if I was to have to choose one, it would have to be the Khmer culture of Cambodia.
Okay.
And reasons being, I've been to Cambodia more than any other country in the world. 14
yeah.
times I've been to Cambodia, mainly with school trips, mm-hmm. taking students to work alongside my people. Obviously, if you know your history, you know Cambodia had a very rich and prosperous history many, many years ago, but in the 70s under the Khmer Rouge and Pol Pot, obviously a very sad recent history. They're just rebuilding out of that. So their culture is a fascinating one. I love their curiosity, their tenacity and creativity, just to make the best of the situation they have and how they've learned to adapt. I love. And their food is amazing. It's not Vietnamese. It's not Thai. It's just their own. I think beef lok lak is my favourite dish that I... I try and recreate at home. It's never quite the same. I think I need that. I think it's camp hot pepper. I think it's some special pepper they have that I don't have in Australia. But, the Kamaya people, just a beautiful, generous, gracious people.
Yeah.
And really it's been quite powerful over the years. I think I first went there in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the development, some of it not great, just with different influences coming in, but just to see how their country is slowly getting back on their feet and lifting that standard of living across the board has been quite,
And especially given the traumatic history that they experienced.
And still very raw history for a lot of them. But, so that is a culture that I just love. And I've taken my boys, I have three boys, and when they were quite little, I took them to Cambodia so they could experience that. And they just loved it. So,
Brilliant. Thank you for sharing that. So, as you know, this is a podcast about shifts.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if you can tell me about a time when you experienced a shift, when you suddenly became aware of a new perspective.
Mm. So I have a story, and it might seem very insignificant, but looking back, it was actually the very first big shift for me. And I was in the Philippines, actually, and I was a school teacher, and I was working in some schools in the Philippines because the part we were working in just had a huge youth problem, dropping out of school, some drug addictions. And so they were trying to get people in to kind of give a bit of an encouraging message about the positive aspect of school and education. So I was over there doing some work, and I had a hat on, and I was walking through this little barangay, this little village, with my interpreter. And I had my hat, as was the custom, I was, in my 20s, had my hat pulled down quite low. And we were
like a cap.
Yeah, like a cap. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just pulled down kind of quite close to my eyes, down low, just how we used to wear it.
Yeah.
And my interpreter said, "Oh, don't wear your hat like that." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Oh, no, lift your hat higher up on top of your head." I'm like, "Oh, no, this is how I wear my hat. Like, it's fine." He's like, no, you don't understand. In our village, if you pull your hat down like that, it means you're up to no good. Like, you're going to do something wrong because the people don't want to see you."
Okay.
And I'm like, it might just seem an insignificant story, but for me, I can distinctly remember doing something that is normal back home,
mm-hmm.
doing exactly the same thing can be interpreted so differently in that situation. And so that was a real shift for me about running a bit of a filter through what I say, what I do, and how that might be interpreted. And this is before I ever knew anything about cultural intelligence or anything like that. It was just something that I realised. So that was a memorable moment.
Why do you think you saw that other perspective instead of, sticking to you, doesn't matter?
Well, I have to admit, my immediate reaction was, what are you talking about? This is how we wear a hat. But I think he was quite earnest when he said it. Like, and I think it was his, and I can understand now looking at it, he was obviously trying to win approval in this village to try and get them to turn from crime and things.
Right.
And I can see how it would look now if the person you're trying to help, encourage young people to take a positive path is someone who they look at and think, oh, they're dodgy. To use an Australian term,
yes.
Dodgy. I can see that would just blow everything they're trying to do. So he was quite earnest. I think that his intensity of, no, you can't do that, really hit me. So.
And good that you were able to see that and step into it. You work with students and their development in terms of their own personal skills.
Yeah.
And that means you must often be thinking about them and how to help them shift in similar ways as well. So it might be attitudinal shifts. It might be behavioural shifts.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about your process of working with them and what you're thinking about as you're doing it.
Yeah, look, that is basically what teachers try and do every minute of every day.
We try and
shift, whether it's shifting their thinking to learning something new, appreciating a new perspective. So what we try and do is, a few different ways. The biggest thing and the subjects areas I teach are all to do with, I think, personal development at the moment. So I think helping students have the ability to empathise is the way that you shift their thinking, lasting thinking. You can get them to regurgitate something.
Yes.
and that's fine. They'll just give you what you want. Yeah. But if we really, and I think all educators deep down, this is what they want to do, is make lasting change so that you almost become obsolete because the children have adapted that belief system for themselves. In order to do that, you really need to get them to understand and empathize for themselves. And there's a few ways we can do that. We can take them on immersive trips.
Yep.
And when we do trips overseas, we do local trips, we do service learning, working with the Salvation Army, with the homeless.
Yeah.
Like all these things we try and do. I mean, obviously you need to have the resources to do that. And
yes,
we're fortunate
yes.
the school I work at does have that. But there are other things that we use visible thinking. So out of Harvard, visible thinking tools are tools designed to their routines that the students can learn to kind of step out of their own little bubble, because we know one of the greatest challenges of young people today is that they are in their own little world.
Yeah.
It has been created just for them. There's no compromise. Whatever they want to watch, listen to, whenever they want to, they can. So to help them to step outside and empathize, we use these visible thinking routines and get them to articulate that, and then we can have discussion around that, and they can hear different people's perspectives on why this perspective might be for the greater good rather than just individual benefit. So, yeah, it's a few little tools.
So how does the visible thinking routine work?
Well, there's quite a few of them. So if you just search up Harvard, it came out of Project Zero. A guy called Ron Rithart kind of developed it. A lot of schools use it these days. A couple of examples. There's feelings and options. So you choose some sort of situation or dilemma. Okay, it might be any situation. Some could be, students teasing someone else because of a different background, or they're having a different type of food for lunch, whatever it might be. And then you just step them through. So you might get them to identify who are the people involved in this situation and what challenge are they facing. The second step is feel. So what do you think each person is feeling in this situation?
Mm-hmm.
Why might the situation be hard or challenging for them?
Mm-hmm.
And step three is imagine. Imagine options, how the situation could be handled. So then they come up with lots of different ideas. Some of them might be quite negative, but then they go through and circle which option might lead to the most positive outcome, where people feel good or are taken care of.
Mm.
And then the last step is say. So thinking about the idea, what could the people involved say to make that happen?
Mm-hmm.
So that's just a simple routine that done in class and work in small groups and then share back.
Yes.
It actually exposes people to different ways of thinking rather than just their own, because that's the biggest challenge we find. Sometimes students are just locked in because they know no different.
Well, they've been raised by their parents to think a certain way.
That's right.
Yeah.
And if the parents aren't thinking and encouraging that.
So do you find that people can step into that way of thinking and then just regurgitate is the wrong word, but then it becomes a habit.
Yeah.
And so then they will step through those processes.
Yeah, well, that's why they're called routines. And the power behind them is that we use them across the school.
Right, yeah.
So they're not just walking into some class, they're doing some random activity. They go, oh, we're doing this. And there's another one is the three whys. So it might be, why might this topic or question matter to me?
Yeah.
Why might it matter to people around me, like family or friends or in the country? And then why might it matter to the world and get them articulate?
Yes.
So if they're doing that in geography, in history, in personal capacity class, like they become familiar with actually expressing different viewpoints or the ability to actually see different perspectives.
To switch that perspective from me to others to the world. Yeah.
So in terms of you're talking about shifting in young people, that is a very powerful. Mm-hmm. And as I said, a lot of schools use these tools.
That's brilliant.
So it's been working.
And so do you have sort of moments where you can see that happening, where you sit there and you see it, students making those trips?
Yeah. I think for me, because I run a lot of overseas service trips, I mean, if you want to rank things, they are the most powerful. And coming back to the story about Cambodia, going to Cambodia, and there's a visible thinking routine that goes, I used to think,
Yes.
Now I think.
Yes.
And we get the students to do that at the end.
Yeah.
And that. They are some of the most powerful statements. Things like, I used to think we were going overseas to help people, but now I think they've helped me more than I could ever help them, just in terms of their resilience, creativity, positivity. Quite powerful.
Yes, which shows a shift in thinking about where we sit in relation to other people. Yeah.
And the value we place on material wealth as a source of happiness and everything we want when it's not true at all.
That's right. We're not necessarily the happiest country in the world, even though we might have things that other countries don't.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So thank you for that. Your work with cultural intelligence, tell us a little bit about that and what you've been doing for students with that, what you're in the process of developing, and I guess what you're hoping for as well.
So we've used cultural intelligence quite a few years at our school. We've actually been honoured with a couple of Australian Education Awards for our use in cultural intelligence. And how we've used that is not only training with students, but before we do, look our situation in Noosa, I don't know the listeners are aware of the areas of Australia. I don't think you probably get a more monocultural area than Noosa. Maybe Sutherland.
The Sutherland Shire, where I live, is quite monocultural as well.
But, Noosa is. And, look, as we say, there's nothing to be embarrassed or ashamed about. It is what it is.
Yeah.
But we need to acknowledge it isn't the real world. We talk about the Noosa bubble. And if our students are going to be going to university in big cities or collaborating with people around the world, which is what they will be doing, you know, they need to know how to adapt to different cultural situations. And so we've been working very hard trying to give them opportunities to do that with people coming in overseas trips. And part of the training has been in cultural intelligence, pre-trip testing, our training in cultural intelligence, and then post-trip testing. And we have seen the four areas of cultural intelligence, which you explained in the introduction, increase on average about 30% for each student.
Okay.
And it's interesting, the different trips, if they're less, I'll use the word intense, if the younger years, it doesn't increase as much.
Okay.
So there's a direct correlation with immersion, what they see, how enmeshed in a local community they are.
That's brilliant.
And the increase in cultural intelligence. So we've been doing that for quite a few years. But I wanted to scale that up. And so what I've been writing through the CQ Fellows program is a course in cultural intelligence for young people. And this is young people in schools or universities or even, you know, it could be in corporate settings where if you've got a young workforce, that's a self-guided course online, short videos, questions, reflective questions to get a base level knowledge about mainly the cultural dimensions and how people sit on that spectrum.
Yeah, so Tim's speaking about the value differences. So there's a number of our interviewees who have spoken about different values and how they've impacted their thinking, you know, from collectivism and individualism to high power distance and low power distance. And so those cultural continuums of thinking are often the things that we're not aware of within ourselves. They are things that we grow up just accepting as ways of thinking. And so to understand that people think differently often creates quite a shift.
So that's what it is. So it's an online course that our students will all do, but then we will share that with other schools around the world. And we already had a lot of interest. I actually had a few not-for-profit companies who do work in other countries who are going to make every person who volunteers with them do this course. Because they just see the value in being prepared to go into another culture and not, you know, stuff things up and, you know, offend people.
It
makes sense. So that's what we've been working on. So it's quite an exciting project and a lot of work, but I think it's going to, have a lot of benefit.
Yeah. And so in terms of, helping other people to work with it, are other people going to be using it just as a off-the-shelf resource, do you think, or will teachers use it and teach to it?
Well, there's a couple of ways. So it will be a standalone micro-credential.
Okay.
So it will be so it's called Sequest, and so you can get it for your school and you could just have it as an optional for students if they want to use it as part of their resume. It's linked to International Baccalaureate and Australian Curriculum Outcomes, so you could chuck it in a, you know, humanities course or something and do it, and it'll tick up all the boxes, which teachers will love, as, you know, student individual work or a hybrid, watch the videos, we discuss this as a class sort of resource.
Yeah.
A few different options.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And so the outcomes of it include helping students to make those shifts of thinking.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And that's the whole idea. At the end, and even that language is in throughout the course.
Yeah.
I mean, how has this shifted thinking after doing? Because you want them to, it's a big part of it is self-reflection.
It is, yeah.
So and getting them to understand that.
So the self-reflection component that you've built in, is that like journaling-based? Is it discussion-based? What's the situation?
So basically it is just getting them to kind of put themselves on a scale because I have made it so that you can just follow the bouncing ball, go through on an online course. So as soon as you start taking journaling discussion, we will encourage them to do that on their own.
Yeah.
But the course is more slide how you, about this situation, how you feel.
Yeah.
If it's a classroom-based, then obviously it's discussion in their workbooks, how that might be.
Yeah.
But journaling is a powerful, you know, to articulate your thoughts.
But even the process, like as you've intimated, there's a slider.
Mm.
And so they're thinking about that process and then having to move.
Yep.
And so that in and of itself is a shift tool that, you know, we haven't sort of thought about before.
Yeah. And questioning why not. If they're not planning on moving, if they don't, if they have a fixed mindset about something, what's the reason behind it?
Yes.
Get them to, you know, ask the hard questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Love that.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Tim. Is there anything else you want to add that you haven't, you know, that you've thought about that you haven't had a chance to share? Or
I don't think so. I just see huge potential just in young people. And it's always been my dream, I guess, to, you know, we talk about all this work in cultural intelligence with executives and people already in business, but if we can grow this, you know, from the grassroots level, I think we can, you know, really hopefully make an impact in the world around us with the increased understanding and relationships, which is, I know is a lofty ambition, but, you know, we have to start somewhere.
Absolutely, and let's aim for lofty ambitions and change the world.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Tim. Really appreciate all your thoughts and the stories that you've shared here. It's wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And please, if you would like to tune in next week, push that follow button on your app, on your podcast app, and we'd also love it if you could rate us. And see you again next week.